Good morning, everyone. We like to continue today with our introduction to control theory, and we'll essentially move to this towards the idea of PID control. And for this purpose, it might be a good idea to look through the different parts which contribute to full-fledged PID control, which we essentially will talk about next time. So today, we will continue maybe to consider a little bit this example which we started last time, but now in a setting where it's not only the question how to understand it, how to set it up, but really how to control the vehicle under these conditions. So we have been starting last time with different control paradigms. So as soon as you know essentially what to do, if you have, for example, a good map of your environment and you know sufficiently precisely where your robot is, then you can just calculate what kind of actions the robot has to do in order to arrive at the target location. There might be some disturbances in the environment, which obviously will affect the quality of the control in these cases. In some other cases, maybe, for example, if the robot knows that it's very close to the wall, then obviously there is some kind of disturbance to be expected, and so maybe the robot can already slow down, take this into account in order to be less sensitive to these disturbances. But in a general robot, either of these approaches would have its disadvantages, so it can always be that there are some kind of unexpected disturbances, which in both cases would be not really very helpful for the task of the robot. And that's why many of the control applications rather use this feedback paradigm, meaning that there is some kind of continuous flow of measurements, of sensory values, which are then used to adapt the behavior of the robot as an input to a certain control law, which changes the motor command such that the effects of these disturbances are suppressed. It's not always a straightforward task and requires some understanding of the system, but not at the same level as it is required by these types of control. So here you really have to have an inverse model which as precisely as possible describes what to do in order to achieve a certain reaction of the robot. Here it's more this idea of a control law, some kind of a scheme which makes sure that these disturbances are suppressed, but typically it does not need to be as precise in the other ones, as we will see in a minute. So, for example, if you have this thermostat control of the temperature in a certain room, air convection and heat distribution in a room is a very complex phenomenon, which would take lots of effort to model it appropriately. But as soon as you have this kind of closed loop behavior that you always measure temperature and just make sure that you switch on and off the heating if necessary, then you can still have a fairly constant temperature in the room without the necessity of modeling all the details of the physical characteristics of the airflow. This is also used maybe on a very low level in servo motors, where you essentially specify the angle, for example, the motor should approach. And for this purpose, the motor decides, so to say, by itself what kind of voltage is needed in order to realize this angle. Of course, in a certain range, at some point, the servo will also be overloaded, but at least you have only to care about sensory effects or about what kind of effect you, the robot should achieve, what kind of angle you should achieve, and all these more actuatory related quantities, like voltages or torque, are essentially done by some kind of a low-level control mechanism. Of course, there are all kinds of more complex variants of feedback control. For example, you could ask what is the fastest way to approach a certain goal state, or is there any kind of optimal strategy if you have particular types of noise, but things getting much more complicated and assume typically that you need that you have more information about the system available. So this very implicit model or very qualitative model which is required is a major advantage really of these feedback control systems, what I said already. And in this way, the control scheme is usually much more simple. It will not be trivial in a sense. Usually you have to add a number of different terms to react to different types of errors or to different effects of errors in the system, but it's still generic in the sense that you can use pretty much the same controllers for lots of different applications, whereas in open loop control, you really have to make sure that your controller fits precisely not only to the robot itself, but also to features of the environment. Even given this kind of sloppiness in modeling, which is implicit in feedback control, you achieve typically more robust behavior in the sense that the robot or the robot by the means of the controller is able to deal with different types of disturbances from what you have expected. So, I mean, this body temperature control in humans is maybe not the most suggestive example in the sense that it's a highly complex control system, which is not just in multidimensional generalization of what we will learn here. But it's obvious that even if you are brought outside the typical living conditions, for example, to in some medical treatments, you have to survive minus 100 degrees of degrees centigrade. But you still survive such conditions just because the control is generically set up to deal with, let's say, a very large range of disturbances. So maybe it's not really a disadvantage, but it's some kind of additional requirement is that obviously in order to monitor the quality of the behavior, sensors are required, which is not necessarily so for open loop. For the feed forward, it depends whether you have either some kind of external knowledge or whether you also have an sensor. For example, in this thermostat example, so you could, for example, have a sensor which measures temperature outside the room and which also feeds in some information to maybe just increase the general heating power if it's cold outside, even if this is not directly related to the temperature in the room. Feedback control involves always a gain parameter, meaning if you determine or if you sense and distance from your target state by this and this amount, then you need to have some kind of factor how this translates into an appropriate action. And these gain factors might be a little bit difficult, especially if you have delays in the feedback loop. It takes some time from measuring a certain deviation until you can react it. So typically, if you just upregulate, for example, your force a little bit, in the case of the detection of the, of a deviation. Of course, it takes a long time before you can really make up for this. There might be other disturbances happening meanwhile, such that this might not be a very precise control. If you react very heavily, then of course the system can become unstable, especially again in this delayed feedback scenario. We will have a look to this distinction later. In practice, it's always very helpful if you know when the system is unstable. And it was really a major advance in science in general when Maxwell analyzed the behavior of the steam engine controlled by a watt governor and found that it can either reach this kind of target velocity or it becomes oscillatory, and this is pretty much everything, all that can happen in such a system. As a mathematical proof, this is quite nice. You know that you have to deal essentially only with a single type of deviation, and he was able to show what kind of countermeasures you should take against this oscillation that this opening and closing of the valve will lead to some kind of undulations of the speed of the motors. So this might become a little bit clearer when we look at this example, which we have been studying last time. So it was a simple case of a motor which is driven by an input from a battery, a power input from a battery, and this is the voltage would be the red part, and this voltage translates into two contributions. So one is really what drives the robot forward, the acceleration of the robot. S was the velocity, and so the derivative of the velocity would be the acceleration. Of course, this depends on the mass of the robot and also on the resistance of the which occurs inside the motor. But on the other hand, there are also these electrical properties of the motor. So by producing a magnetic field, it counteracts, so to say, the battery power or the battery current. And in this way, the motor is not completely effective. Not all of the battery power is translated into an acceleration. So if we want to run the robot at a certain speed, which would be this S goal here. We could, for example, try to adjust battery power in such a way that any kind of deviations from this goal are compensated. So this control law here. I'm sorry, this doesn't really work anymore. This control law shows that the battery power will be increased or will be large if you have maybe a very small velocity and you are far away from the goal. Of course, this depends on this K, which plays essentially this role of the, or which plays the role of this gain factor here. So meaning that if K is very large, then we would put a lot of power into the system if there is some deviation. On the other hand, if we, for some reason, have exceeded the goal velocity, or if we want to slow down, then this would translate into a negative voltage, which counteracts the motor as long as we are above the goal. So if we want to understand this, it's quite easy. Once we have accepted this equation up here, we can insert our ansatz or our control law into the battery power here, which after moving this K times S to the other side leaves us just with a very similar equation, except that this K1 is now replaced by K1 plus K. So we can just look for the formulas, how to deal with such equations that we have been studying last time. So one way is always to assume that the velocity has reached a stationary level, that this temporal derivative is zero, so we get rid of this part of the equation, and we arrive at this equation for the steady state, which tells essentially that k doesn't have too much influence here in this case, but the K1 effect is more or less the same as we had previously. We can also ask how fast the system is approaching this stationary state. This is given by the half time. So if you have a certain distance from the goal, then this would describe how long it takes to make up for half of this distance towards the goal. And we see, of course, that if the robot has a large mass, for example, it takes longer. Or on the other hand, if we have a large K, meaning we put a lot of energy into the compensation of any deviations from the goal state, if we have a large K, then this half-life becomes smaller, so we get faster to the goal state. On the other hand, of course, if you look at this, this looks a little bit suspicious already, and indeed, if we ask ourselves, for example, our goal is maybe 10 meters per second, for example, what kind of K we should choose in order to realize this speed, then it becomes obvious, just inserting into our equation. So we are asking for the stationary speed after a long time. So we cancel again this first term of this equation, and we end up with this as a steady state equation, which obviously cannot really be satisfied for any non-zero K1 here. So K1 is the efficiency of the motor, essentially. We cannot hope that the motor is arbitrarily efficient. So this K1 will always be larger than zero. We will never really reach our goal velocity, which is not really a good behavior of this approach. Why? The question is, of course, what happened here? What was wrong? That the goal of the control is not actually realizable in this sense. One hint can be immediately or can be seen from this control law. So what happens here is, as soon as a robot reaches the goal, then this battery voltage is set exactly to zero. So even if the robot really runs at the desired speed, of course it would still need energy in order to compensate for this inefficiency, or possibly also compensate friction and so on. So this is not really a good idea, and the robot has no other choice, so to say, as taking some kind of deviation from the goal into account in order to get at least as much energy as it needs to reach this state. Of course, we could just increase the gain, but obviously this gain is bounded by the total power of the battery. We cannot take out more than we have in the battery. And so in most cases, in the typical cases, we will not have infinite or very large gain, such that there will be some kind of steady state error, which is just implied by the inefficiency of the motor and also by the gain of the control, by the gain of the control, okay, here. So how does it look like in the beginning? If you are very far from the goal state, which is meant to be here, in the beginning you can still improve in much the same way as you would do it optimally. But as soon as you get closer, the available power by the battery becomes lower and lower, and so the robot just cannot make it and will stay at a distance from the goal state, which is related to its inefficiency, essentially. Of course, we could have chosen a different control law, maybe in such a way that it adds another. Probably it's a good idea to have some kind of regulation which depends on the distance from the goal. So we could simply add some kind of term which gives the robot the right power to run at the goal speed. Yeah? But we would need really to know this in the sense of a forward model in order to add it here. Yeah? So for each of the goal speeds, we would need to calculate or experimentally to find out what kind of battery power we need. And then we can put it in and take this kind of term only in addition to this for an additional compensation. So we would essentially work with a forward model in this case, which is a possibility, of course, but it might also be a good idea to think a little bit whether there is a way to deal with these kind of errors, of these undershoots of the target velocities. Essentially, yes. Yeah. So that's the idea in feedback control. Of course, if you take this approach, then you might fail, as this example shows. Yeah. So if you didn't take into account the inefficiency of the motor, which cannot just let a robot run at a constant speed without input, yeah, so, then you can run into these problems. But they are not unsolvable, yeah, even without explicit knowledge of the system. But it's not exactly true that you don't need to know anything about the system. So what you need, for example, to know is the sign of the control law. So if you have, for example, reversed your battery, then it wouldn't really work in this approach. So there are some assumptions. And of course, also, if you are really outside any reasonable range for K, so you should know K by an order of magnitude, which, of course, in most cases can be found out by a few tests only. So obviously, it's quite simple, this approach, and it's very powerful in the sense that it can reduce large deviations from the goal quickly. There might be some kind of problems, not only the steady state error, which we have seen in the previous example, but it might also maybe overshoot and show some oscillations, which not even need always to be decaying. Yeah? It could also lead to oscillations which build up and which have a bad influence on the system.
May I ask?
Yeah, please. So this was an quantity in the model. Maybe we go back here. So this K2 is describing how this mass translates into the requirement. It's essentially a quantity, into the requirement for energy, a quantity which translates the units from masses to energy, or from a torque into the battery power. So we didn't want to go into details. We just assumed that these are positive constants. Some coefficients. So if you are given an example like this one here to calculate, you will be given these values. For a robot, for a real robot, maybe you can look in the manufacturer's description. But what you typically would do is you would fit the parameters. So these quantities, half-life and steady state, can be measured. And if you do, if you measure it, maybe for different control strengths or maybe for different voltages, might be for different constant voltages, for example, then you are able to estimate these quantities. So as soon as you have an error, so maybe there's also a possibility, especially if we are talking about a system which can measure such errors, a possibility to counteract. Of course, the error is small, and it might be not a good idea to deal with these small quantities, which can also be very noisy. So an interesting approach to deal with this is not to take these kind of deviation simply, but in order to get some kind of additional knowledge, whether this error, for example, persists or whether it will eventually be regulated away, is to look at these integrated errors. So as soon as an error really persists, even if it's very small, this integral over time will accumulate sufficient information that there is really some problem to be dealt with. And once you have this kind of error term, maybe it's a reasonable strategy, in addition to our fast and powerful action to the robot, to have a kind of more slow adaptation with respect to these remaining errors. So you just wait for some time to have a sufficient contribution in this integral. So as soon as, of course, both are coinciding, the goal speed and the current speed of the robot, then this integral will not grow any further. You might, of course, expect that if you have really built up here a large error for waiting for some time before this error is regulated away, then this integral might have built up. You would need to have some kind of overshoot to the other side. So you need to make sure that this integral term is not very big, meaning that any kind of prefactor is quite small, such that any negative effects of this part are counterbalanced by a more fast reaction, and only small terms which are not dealt with by this term are actually captured by this integral term. So the balance between the different terms we will have a look at next time, but this seems to be a reasonable approach. Just wait whether a small error persists. If so, even with a small prefactor, it might give some kind of reasonable addition to the control quantity and improves in this way the behavior of the robot. So this is one way to deal with it. We have been able to introduce this proportional control into the systems equation and to have a look at what is the effect. And we, in this way, we were able to identify this undershoot. For the integral controls, it's not as easily possible. We would need to use more mathematics, Laplace transform in particular, to understand how this happens. So we will just take it here as an additional term, and we'll test next time experimentally how it influences the behavior of the robot. On the other hand, there's this problem that maybe the both this integral term as well as the proportional term can lead to oscillation. So you have produced in movements towards the goal, but the robot has lots of inertia and might just overshoot and does the opposite error just a little time later. And one way to deal, it seems to be necessary to have a third component into the control law, which is able to dampen such oscillation, and this will be the differential part of the control. But before we come to this, maybe we will have some kind of understanding of oscillations. So most of these control approaches, in addition, so that's one other condition, so to say, which you need to have, is that the control law is essentially instantaneously, that's practically not possible, but that any kind of delays between measurement and counteraction are dealt with on a very short time scale. So if this is not possible, as in this example, then you can probably guess what would happen here. So if you have this one-dimensional track and you push maybe a box back and forth according to these rules, so if you are outside the target area, then you move forward in the positive direction, or if you are on the other side, you move backward. And only if you arrive at the target location, then you stop. Huh? So if you, of course, what happens if there's a delay depends on the delta, but if delta is relatively small and you are just a little bit maybe more to the negative side, then if you wait for 1 second, you will have passed already this target location, and you have arrived at the other side, you push back and you will just continue to oscillate between positive and negative deviations simply because the instruction what to do arrives too late when you have already dealt with the error. You don't know when to stop at the correct time. So this, in addition to these kind of intrinsic instabilities, for example, by this integral control, the delays will also be a source of oscillations, which is sometimes not too bad. So, for example, the movement systems in animals is exactly using these types of oscillatory systems, so it's not really relying that on the fact that maybe control could go wrong, but it really produces actively oscillations in a very similar way. So maybe this unit A here receives some kind of external input in the sense of an go signal, an unspecific or start signal, for example. This activates unit A. So if unit A is active, has some kind of elevated activity, then it activates another unit B. And this unit B has, on the other hand, this property to inhibit activity in A. So A switches on B, B switches off A. Of course, if A is switched off, then it cannot activate any further B. So that means B stops also to be active. And then A can again pick up the external go signal and become active again. Or maybe A is just by itself active. So in this sense, you have a complete cycle, which you can use, for example, to control walking movements. So these kinds of loops are present in our spinal cord and help us to produce certain types of rhythms, which are not only important for the control of repeated movements, but possibly also generate certain elements of movement sequences. If you just make a half a step or something like this, then you would probably use also exactly the same architecture in your spinal cord to guide you through the trajectory. Yeah, so there are a number of examples where also in robotics people have used exactly these principles, be it in juggling where you have just an periodic movement, which is not exactly periodic, so you need some kind of control as well, in order to adapt the period of the control and maybe the translation of this oscillation into the location of the arms and fingers. You leave, so to say, the control to this, or the movement generation to this periodic movement, and you just control for deviations from the periodic trajectory. Or here in this case, which is also observed in many animals, there are some kind of movement generators which produce these wiggly movement of the body. And if you adapt again, for example, these influences between unit A and B correctly, then you get a movement which is very much in synchrony with properties of the water outside. So sometimes we want these types of oscillations, on the other hand, in many other cases we don't, and so it might be a good idea to be able to deal with oscillations as well, which can be produced either by overshoots of the system or by some kind of other type of energy storage in the system. So even if you are back to the, or if you arrive at the goal state, the object can still have some kind of inertia, and this inertia just wants to proceed further, even if the control law implies that this is not necessary. These oscillations will not occur in very simple systems as the one which we have seen in the beginning. So as soon as you have a single variable and only a first order differential equation, where there's just a single derivative, then oscillations are not possible, and it's quite generally provable. So as soon as you have this differential equation up there, meaning that a quantity x determines via a function f how this quantity is changed, we can visualize it in such a way that this function f is given here by the black line, and the effect of f onto the value of x, so x is living only on the horizontal axis, is simply if f is negative, then x
has a tendency to move to the left, and if f is positive, then x would move to the other side. So in this case, for each x, what happens is quite fully described by the equation. Yeah? So it will probably arrive. Maybe it can run away in this part, and in other parts it will arrive at these points here where the function intersects with the x-axis, where this function is zero and the x cannot go away anymore. But as soon as you have maybe a two-dimensional space for x, then obviously even if you have such arrows, the arrows can of course lead in a circle or in higher dimension, in second-order differential equations, as we will have a look now, this is also possible. So how would a second-order differential equation look like? It's essentially the same what we have seen before. So there is some kind of energy or torque here, which depends on the first order derivative here. But there is also some kind of inertia, which has a different effect. So our previous equation was actually of not of this type with j equal to 0. But of the type with f equal to 0, because we were talking about acceleration, about a speed. Here in this case, maybe in order to have a natural description, we take into account the place. Or in the case of a robot arm, for example, the place is described by the angle of the robot. And in order to move this arm from one angle to a different angle, we would have such an equation. So there's, on the one hand, we have this acceleration, which is the speed was the first derivative of the angle, or angular speed would be the first derivative of the angle, and acceleration or angular acceleration would be the second derivative. And of course, this depends on the inertia of the arm. So if the arm is heavy, we simply need more torque from the motor. And on the other hand, we have a different term which depends only on the speed and which describes the friction of the arm. So if there's larger speed, the friction is typically higher. This might not be very important, this part, but it will need to be, we should consider it. So again, we could try to start with this proportional control. So here it makes more sense because we can probably assume that the arm just stays in a position at a certain goal angle. That we don't need to put torque, well, so unless maybe the arm has to counteract gravity, maybe it's just moving in the horizontal plane. This could make sense. So we wouldn't really need to think about steady state errors, so the problem might be solvable with this proportional controller here. However, if we have a look at the equation. In this case, it's still possible to calculate a solution, but it's maybe easier to look the solution up somewhere, which looks like this. So whatever f and j we have, we will have these kind of components. Again, there is some kind of exponential, but in contrast to this previous example where we use the exponential essentially to approach a certain goal, here the argument of the exponential, this omega, is given by a square root, the square root might not be solvable. So in some cases, you will have negative arguments to the square root, and in this case, the solution is complex. So this means e to an imaginary number translates into a cosine, and this is exactly an oscillatory solution. Again, here are some constants which are not in the same. So f and j are the describing the system, you know, the torque and the friction of the system, and the c1 and c2 are just what you have to insert in order to specify how you start or where you are starting from. The initial angle and also whether there is some kind of initial oscillatory velocity, and this gives you estimates of these two constants. So it is a typical rule in differential equations. If you have a first order differential equation, you need to insert one constant, and in the second order differential equation, there are two constants, but it's also implied by the
task or by the kind of the equation, what kind of information you can use.
So obviously, if you want to analyze this square root, we can just check what happens in order to produce what case. So if the inertia is very large, that in this case you will observe this kind of oscillatory behavior, meaning if you have large mass in the system, then you really would need to counteract very strongly, or maybe to have lots of friction in the system, not in, to enter this kind of oscillatory regime. On the other hand, if maybe the mass is small here in the second, in this line, or if the friction is very large, then the system would exponentially converge, but it can possibly take a long time before it really reaches the critical state. So what is interesting is this kind of limiting case where you are quickly approaching the goal, but you are not producing any overshoots due to these oscillatory dynamics. Of course, as soon as you have maybe to counteract gravity, that means in order to keep the robot arm at a certain angle, you need to have some constant torque. In these cases, you have very much the same effect as in this steady state error for our motor control. And you need either to compensate for this or again to work with an integral error which picks up these deviations. And that's also what you observe in a human. So if I give you some object where you are not really sure what the weight is, as soon as you pick it up, usually you give in a little bit. Yeah? So you will feel this load drop or droop. Only after you have realized that it results in a deviation, you can go back. There will be always this kind of small giving in to the load, which indicates that we are probably using similar mechanisms. So here in this case, again, integral control or control which is proportional to the integral PI will be able to deal with the load droop present in the case of a movement against gravity. So we are still not sure what to do about oscillations, overshoots, and we have seen in the discussion of the square root that maybe large friction would possibly counteract oscillations caused by large inertia of the system, but maybe it's not really a good idea to have systems with large friction. It could be a better idea to use some kind of artificial friction, so to control the system such that it behaves as it had large friction while it is in the danger of producing oscillations, but otherwise maybe it should not really have physical friction, which just eats up our input. Yeah? And for this purpose, in addition maybe to this proportional control, or maybe in addition to the proportional and integral control, we add another term which is proportional to the differential and which can just take up the role as the friction in the real system. So in this kind of equation up here, we just put this control as an additional friction term, and that's what we have to study in these cases. So taken together, what we have now is this kind of control loop. So here is a system on the right-hand side, and this will lead to some kind of an angle of the arm or possibly also position of the robot and so on. And we take the derivative of this one for later use. But most importantly, we take just the angle or the control quantity, compare it with the target or with the goal value. And this error is used in the proportional control, which will account for most of the deviations. In addition, we integrate also these errors up there. And this will help us to detect small deviations, small inaccuracies, which persist for a longer time. On the other hand, we also can include here this last term below, which may smooth which may smooth out certain oscillations by overshoots, by possibly also by caused by delays in the system. On the other hand, of course, we should be careful about this differential term, because that's real data which can be noisy, and taking derivative of noisy data is not a good idea. So either you make sure that this is not a very big effect, yeah, this artificial friction, or it might be a good idea to include as well some smoothing constraints into the derivative. That you just make sure that any measured derivative is not too different from previously measured derivatives. Because the main part of the control is taken up by this proportional, it's usually not really critical to have your very big effects. And so the control should work quite well if the roles are assigned accordingly, and the weights are chosen accordingly. Of course, there might be some more discussion necessary in order to choose these values, and we will discuss this the next time. If we have still a few minutes, maybe I want to jump to the end of next lecture, because this might be interesting in some respect. So that's what we will be talking on Friday. We should maybe try to incorporate this into a larger scheme. Yeah? So if you analyze a certain problem in order to find an implementation in a robot, it might be a good idea to go back to this classical architecture, which we have been criticizing a couple of times already. But usually you would run it in the analysis in the reverse way, so you know what the robot is supposed to do, and then you have to go back and to ask what kind of information needs to be processed in order to be able to do this, and what kind of measurements have to be taken from the environment in order to be able to produce these plans. Yeah? So there are some kind of problems with this one, and people have been discussing these. So one of the major people, scientists in this respect, was Rodney Pooks, who really triggered a kind of revolution in robotics, and most of the present robots, not directly, but at least from the inspiration, really follow these suggestions, which are a little bit overstated here, which are very much into the heart of the situation in robotics, maybe in the 80s, robots should be as simple as possible. Simplicity is a virtue. It's not really important that you have lots of computational power. Robots should be cheap, and they should be able to survive in a certain environment, or do their task in a certain environment. And it's not really important elephants don't play chess. It's not really important that it can do everything at once. Although, of course, once you have robots which can do some things, then, as we see in the present humanoid robots, it might be a good idea to, you can really combine a number of different functions. But you should not really assume everything, because this just slows down the robot and might not be, be achievable at all. That's what you will probably find as well. If you have some kind of problems and you write a function which deals with a problem, it might really create other problems. So it's always important to use the simplest possible, for a certain environment, the simplest possible solution. And what Rodney Pooks suggested in this, context, in order to be able to deal still with different aspects of the environment, was this so-called subsumption architecture, which means that different behaviors subsume other behaviors. So the robot always, in this sense, knows what to do. Yeah? So for example, it can just move and doesn't have to care anything, unless there are some kind of additional informations available. So as soon as there's maybe some kind of obstacle detected, then the robot should go to the next step and to do some kind of obstacle avoidance. But on the other hand, and this should be really the most important task if an obstacle is there, and all the higher level questions can maybe be left out. If there is no obstacle, then maybe it's a good idea to make sure that this internal representation in the robot is sufficiently updated, or maybe the robot has to take some kind of action to get information about deviations of its internal idea where it is and where it really is. And if this information is reliable, then it can go again. So if there are no errors here, then it can go again to higher and higher problems, aspects of the task, and will in this way be able to do also time-consuming things, but not like always, but only if there is time. Now, people have criticized this. So this kind of doing first things first might be very effective, but could be good to have some kind of overview in complex tasks, like in controlling a car or something like this. But for many simple tasks, as well as maybe for quite animal-like behaviors, it is not really important to have this kind of consciousness. You just need to be able to react appropriately, fast, and to be able to cope with any kind of problems from the environment exactly at the time when they are happening. And that's often sufficient. So he, Rodney Brooks, for example, had this model of cockroaches, which were quite similar to real cockroaches without much intelligence, but appearingly very clever. Such that even if we observe an interesting behavior, it can be produced by, it is possible that it's produced by very simple means rather than by very complex intrinsic representations of the environment. Yeah, so there's always this possibility to decide whether you are more perfectionist and you want really to have all the information in the robot, which comes at a higher cost, or if you do it in a way which is just about to solve the problem and might not be able to deal with lots of variations of the problem. If this is done in a simple way, then you will save a lot of work and you can deal more precisely with a particular environment. So in this sense, or maybe also in other senses, you might have some questions also about the assignment. I don't think we should do this here because we probably will have to leave, but I will be in the robot lab from about 10. So please, unless you have really urgent business at 10, please meet me over there. Thank you very much.